Military personnel are trained to follow orders, and when it comes to problem solving, they take a straightforward route. But what happens when something inexplicable or otherworldly crosses their path? Today, we're sharing stories of military encounters with aliens. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
This is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. Stuff like doppelgangers,
stargates,
skinwalkers,
Mars anomalies,
gnomes,
ancient races of aliens,
remote viewing,
ancient races of giants,
guardian angels,
close encounters of the fifth kind,
Mothman,
human pig hybrids.
All that stuff.
All that stuff and more.
Lots more. I'm Christina Callery.
And I'm Seth Jablon.
And today we're doing stories about
the military and UFOs.
Military and UFOs and or aliens.
Yes. And or, yeah, military sort of governmental agencies, military types of agencies. And I feel like it's like, you know, partly the long sort of story of UFOs in this country, you know, is sort of inexorably bound to UFOs. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm excited about this one. I feel like this one's sort of very timely, right? The you know, those reports that came out through the Air Force or whatever. Right. Like recently they released a bunch of videos.
Right. Right. I mean, they've been doing that for a little while now.
Yeah. But there was like a whole New York Times article, and there was a whole who is the guy from like Blink-182? Remember the whole like Storm Area 51 Facebook,
yes,
phenomena.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay. So they nominate the guy from the lead singer from Blink 182 is like a big UFO guy, right?
Yeah, Tom DeLonge.
Tom DeLonge. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I had to look that up.
He left Blink 182. Good for him. And he decided to use his sort of fame and money to further the research in the sort of UFO phenomenon world. And he did. He literally did. And I think he originally released, or he was like, maybe not the, you know, he didn't like, you know, break the story or anything, but he released some videos out there of the U.S. Air Force tracking UFOs, like on camera. Right. Like on radar. But there's like video footage of it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was like the Air Force kind of like confirmed it. And then the New York Times did this entire article about their UFO tracking program. Right. And then all that took about 2 or 3 years to like slowly come out. In the past year, in 2020, is where like the Air Force was like, yeah, totally, we've been like watching UFOs for a very long time, and they basically like acknowledged their own UFO program. They call them what do they call them now, UAFs or whatever?
Yeah, you're not supposed to call them UFOs anymore.
Yeah, right. It's too like stigmatized, but it's I can't remember the name of it, but it's like unidentified flying.
It's unidentified aerial objects, isn't it?
Aerial phenomena.
Aerial phenomena. Okay.
UAPs. Is that right? Okay.
Yes. So yes, UAPs. You're right.
UAPs. Okay. So I mean, this just happened, right? Like, I mean, we mentioned it on like I think one of the shows a couple months ago, but this just came out. You know, it's been coming out for the past few years, but specifically like the degree that the Air Force is now not only just admitting to you know, the fact that they've had a long-standing UFO research problem, but that they've been doing this not only for a long time, but that they take it very seriously, right? So mm-hmm. up until like 5 years ago, like they'd be like, no, this is ridiculous. Nobody believes in this stuff.
It's swamp gas.
It's
weather balloons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I feel like that reversal is almost more huge than any, you know, the government's been releasing declassified, reports for a very long time, but no one pays attention because of the sort of stance they've had. Mm-hmm. But now that's changing, right?
And so, yeah, I almost did one of those videos, but
oh, really?
I didn't have enough time.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But maybe you did it. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, maybe we'll put something on Instagram or something. I have some like recordings, but I mean, I'm going to make mention of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't know. I'm sure some of our listeners have probably seen, you know, some of these videos out there. It's basically like a bunch of dudes, like, you know, Air Force dudes, like tracking a, I don't know, like they're using some sort of modern technology where they have to like lock in on an object mm-hmm. and they manage to, they call it boxing, and they're like, oh, I boxed him.
Is this the Tic Tac?
Huh?
It's the Tic Tac? Is that what they call it?
Yeah. I think mm-hmm. I think that's the same one. So they're able to put it, like, lock it into their radar. And so they're tracking this thing moving, like, at incredible speeds, and they're all freaking out, right? Which we'll get into all that stuff. But anyways, I feel like this is, like, this show has been, like, I don't know, in a way a long time coming, but also a short time coming. like, you know, it's, like, kind of still breaking news in a lot of ways. Like,
right.
But well, it's also old news, huh?
Yeah, there's so much out there. You know, when you first suggested doing this topic, you can just go down one of just so many rabbit holes.
Yeah.
With varying degrees of believability, you know? But there's definitely some incredibly interesting stories.
Yeah. And I feel like the whole, like, Air Force and UFO subject is really, like I said earlier, like, inexorably bound, like they're in our country at least, right? Like, it's as long as we've been talking about UFOs, there's been encounters between the Air Force and UFOs, right? Like, it's some of the first, I think one of the first published at least UFO sightings was the pilot that called it a flying saucer in the first place, right? I think he was like, I don't think it was on a military mission, but I think he was a USAF pilot that was maybe doing a commercial flight, or maybe he was a regular pilot. But anyways, he's the one who like sort of coined the phrase, you know, flying saucer.
I wonder if he put that in his resume.
Maybe.
I mean, that'd be like a cool thing to,
yeah,
you know, tell people at parties.
Yeah. First saw flying saucer. cool. So, I guess we kind of like already like jump right into it. But
yeah, right. So are you going to go first? Or do you want me to go first?
Whichever. I feel like I kind of went first last time and then, or no, I sort of did like a little intro and then you went, and then I don't know, whichever. Mm-hmm. What do you feel like doing?
Well, you know what? I can go first.
Okay.
So I tried to hold out, but I just couldn't do it, Seth. I knew we were going to do an Antarctica episode later on, right. But I just had to do Antarctica.
Okay.
I went for it. I couldn't resist. Okay. But, you know, think of Antarctica and you probably conjure images as desolate and untouched as the surface of the moon, right?
Yep.
But just as some think that there's a lot more to the moon than meets the eye, and we're going to do that, that's a whole other episode about the moon's so-called dark side. Rumors have been circulating for years that there are secrets hidden deep beneath the ice on this 5.5 million square mile and mostly unexplored continent. So there's a lot of room for mystery there.
Okay.
So, despite frigid 50-mile-an-hour winds and over 98% of its ground cloaked in an ice barrier that's 3 miles thick in places, Antarctica might be home to an underground alien base.
Sweet.
Yes. So in the last few years, I mean, there have been stories going back decades about this, but I'm just covering one specific, you know, thin slice of all of it. And in the last few years, a paranormal researcher and a journalist, her name is Linda Moulton Howe, released interviews with several former U.S. military officers who made an incredible claim that there's not only alien activity, but underground alien bases in Antarctica.
Oh, I love it. I assumed as much, but I'm eager to hear about this.
Okay. So she's got her own YouTube channel called Earth Files, where she posts stuff on all manner of, you know, kind of paranormal, high strangeness subject matter. Some of these stories are also in a documentary that you can find on Amazon called Antarctica, Alien Secrets Beneath the Ice. And her subjects for these interviews were identified only as Brian S., Spartan 1, and Spartan 2. I'm not going to focus on that last one so much because he talked about things, you know, outlying Antarctica. But the men, you know, didn't want to reveal their full identities for obvious reasons, but they were willing to share their stories in interviews as long as their faces, their names, and their voices were obscured. And Howe asserts that she vetted these subjects and that they provided evidence of their military careers. So they weren't just, you know, randos popping up and, you know, spinning yarns. So the first one, called Brian S., which I don't know if for any Room fans out there, the movie The Room reminds me of Chris R. Brian S., that's what he's known by. He was interviewed after he reached out to her in an email in 2015. And Brian said that he was a retired U.S. Navy petty officer, first class flight engineer, who had been stationed at a military base in Antarctica a little over 20 years ago. He flew numerous missions as part of the Antarctic Development Squadron 6, that's the name of it, from around 1983 to 1997. So that's quite a long period of time. And his main job was cargo resupplies for McMurdo Station, which is the American base in the continent. And he and a crew of about 15 to 17 people at a time would fly in a big C-130 plane. And they'd have assignments where they'd have to travel from McMurdo to other stations, like maybe the Australian camp called the Davis Camp, for instance. And on these journeys, they'd have to fly toward the pole, the South Pole, across the Trans-Antarctic mountain range, which goes almost completely across the continent, as his name suggests. And about 5 to 10 miles from the South Pole station, there was an area that was marked as a no-fly zone. So they were instructed, this is a restricted area, you can't fly across it. And so they avoided it. As they were flying toward the pole, they'd have to cross the same area every time. And they would go by this glacier called the Beardmore Glacier. And half a dozen or so times during these journeys, which happened on the regular, it sounds like, they all witnessed the same phenomena. Circular, glinting, silver, disc-shaped craft that would come up over the mountains. They'd be moving at incredible speeds and demonstrating that kind of abrupt, impossible direction change in midair that clearly separate them from anything we've been able to produce with our technology that's known anyway. But they would, it's really interesting because they would never cross over into the glacier. It was almost like there was a territory division for them as well. So they would fly upward. They'd come together in pairs, you know, do all kinds of crazy things, stop in midair, move all around. But they never approached the plane as it passed through, never crossed the glacier. So in the mid-1990s, like around 1996 or 97, they got a call from someone at the Australian camp, the Davis camp, saying that someone there had been severely burned in some kind of a kitchen explosion and they needed an emergency rescue mission. So in order to get there as quickly as possible, the more direct route would make the most sense, right? And that would involve going through this no-fly zone. So the captain called to find out why the restriction was in place and was told that it was, quote, an air sampling or monitoring camp in the area. So they were taking samples of the air and testing it. And so that's why they didn't want aircraft passing over. But this no-fly order didn't add up to the captain or the crew members because they'd be flying at about 35,000 feet and they wouldn't be contaminating the air at the camp. So the captain made the determination, you know, in this emergency moment to go through the restricted zone to get to the injured person as quickly as they possibly could. And I think it was like a 5-hour flight or something, they said. So time was of the essence. Somebody's been, you know, horribly injured. So, but as they flew over the area, which was near the South Pole, which is called At Pole, that's like the terminology they used, the crew members were looking down out of the windows, and to their astonishment, they saw this perfectly shaped circular hole that seemed to have a slant to it that went down like an entrance into the side of the glacier. And they estimated the diameter to be roughly the size of a football field, maybe 300 feet in diameter, going down beneath the ice, but it was perfectly round. So Brian said, quote, "The only thing we saw going over this camp was a very large hole going into the ice. You could fly one of our LC-130 into this thing," which I'm assuming is like an enormous plane.
Yeah, some cool thing. It's
some, yeah, badass plane. So, but they passed over the area and they arrived at Davis. They picked up the injured man, flew him back to McMurdo. And when they landed at the station, there was a man in a suit there waiting for them, which is not your typical Antarctica fashion, you know?
Right. Like he's got, I assume, this is like suit and tie guy.
Like a suit. Yeah. So unless it's like CIA or Intel people.
Right.
And the entire crew was taken together, you know, into a room somewhere. And the man said to them, "What you saw at Pole, you did not see. Not now. Not ever. You do not talk about that hole."
Oh, it's so Men in Black. He was it was definitely like a black suit, right?
It had to be. It had to be, right? Yeah. Okay. So Brian told Howe that there had been rumors, but between 1995 and 1997, they really started to ramp up. So people would be sitting together at bars or in the cafeteria and so forth, and talking about how under the ice near the South Pole, there were extraterrestrials down in a hole that are collaborating with the government.
Oh, awesome. I assumed as much.
Yeah. So not long after this experience, the crew got another assignment. So a group of National Science Foundation researchers were coming in from the United States, and they were tasked with taking these scientists to where they'd be doing their research. So they had to pick them up, escort them safely to, you know, the base where they were going to be, you know, performing whatever experiments they were going to be doing. And they did so. They picked up the scientists, they dropped them off at their destination and left them with an instruction to call the base at McMurdo every 24 hours to check in, let the crew know how they're doing, if they need anything, just to make sure there's no medical emergencies or anything going on that would, like, you know, cause them to put their lives at risk, et cetera. So obviously, you know, this is like a necessity in a place like Antarctica where people are new to the conditions there and haven't lived there. So a week went by, though, and they hadn't heard anything from the scientists. You know, it was just completely crickets. And then the order came through for them to go back to this research facility to check on them, because they hadn't been heard from. Yeah. So they flew back, and as they approached the camp to land, they did it in a way that where they were making large circular, like large circuits in the air with the plane before they landed, just to make sure that if there were any people out there or any animals or any kind of activity, they could kind of survey the area before they landed. And they saw nothing at all. So they landed, and then they checked out the area, and there was no one around. It was as if the entire group of scientists had vanished into thin air. So after doing a thorough check, they returned to the station, and another week went by. So by this time, it's 2 weeks. And you have to think, in a place like that with such extreme conditions, I mean, you know, people go lost at, you know, Yellowstone or national parks here and die of exposure. Just imagine, you know, at the South Pole, you know, the kind of conditions you're dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised they're not launching a search party.
Yeah, I know. I kind of thought of that too. It's like they went back.
Wait, what?
They're like, okay, we're not here. We'll just check back in a couple weeks
and see what, like, see if they're like chilling.
The thought crossed my mind too, but you know, I can't speak to that. I don't know.
Okay.
But after this next week went by, at the 2 week mark, they got another order saying the scientists are back, everybody, but you guys got to go out there and get them. So they went back to the research facility, anticipating that they're going to get there and they're going to find out, you know, what happened to the scientists, like where they were. And also, they're just expecting that the researchers are going to be overjoyed to see them and just come rushing for the plane. Because if they've been lost somewhere, you know, mm-hmm. they've been traumatized. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, just seeing other human
beings.
They've
been saved, right?
Yeah, like, they've been saved. Exactly. Right. So they got there, and the scientists were there, lined up, waiting for them, perfectly still. But they boarded the plane. They don't speak a word to any of the crew members. They're just looking down at the ground, and they look absolutely traumatized. So Brian told Howe.
Or pod people.
Huh?
Or they're pod people.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're right. Maybe. So Brian told Howe it was eerie. They'd been missing for 2 weeks. They looked really scared. They didn't talk to each other. They didn't talk to us, and they kept looking at the ground. At one point, Brian was sitting near one of the scientists, and he extended his hand, and he said, "Is there anything I can get you?" And the scientist never responded, but just kept staring at the floor, which is really bizarre. I mean, it's one thing to be really quiet if you're tired or whatever, but they're able to board the plane, so they're not incapacitated.
Right.
But what's going on? So immediately upon landing back at McMurdo, the scientists were then whisked away in another plane and never heard from again.
Oh, dude.
And so they were told, like, maybe they were taken to New Zealand or someplace like that. But there were rumors making the rounds of the station later from someone who had some kind of intel that the scientists came there to work with the extraterrestrials in that hole, and who knows what happened down there. But not too much longer after the scientists had been flown away, again, men in suits descended and told the assembled crew not to talk, you know, don't talk to anyone about this. Don't mention the scientists. Don't inquire into it. You know, you're not to talk about it. So Brian said, quote, talk among the flight crews was that there is a UFO base at the South Pole, and some of the crew heard talk from some of the scientists working with and interacting with the scientists at that air sampling camp or the large ice hole. So all of this, again, had taken place in the mid-90s. Brian had first emailed Howe in 2015, but in 2016, they finally met up for an in-person chat and interview and meet and greet, and they had dinner. They discussed his story further. But a few days later, Brian's nephew got in touch with Howe and actually told her that Brian had received a call, and a voice on the other end of the line said, "Is this Brian?" And he said, "Yes." And the voice continued, "I want to tell you that what you've been talking about, you need to stop talking about." And so he was asking him, like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "We know that you were with Linda Moulton Howe last Thursday night. And we know that you went to dinner at a Mexican restaurant in Joshua Tree. And we are aware of what you were talking about with her and other people, and that your experience that you had when you were on the ice, when you were in the service, we don't want you talking about that. Specifically, we don't want you talking about the scientist that you picked up after being missing for a couple of weeks." So basically, he was warned away. And then the phone went dead. I'm sorry?
I love that Joshua Tree is a part of this.
And I know, and it's a Mexican restaurant.
Like if you think you're talking about aliens and Joshua Tree, assume people are listening to you.
Okay, so, but interesting fact, Brian was able to do a check on the number after it had come in. He didn't recognize it when it called him. And it had also called his private office number, so this wasn't a public number. And he traced the call to the National Security Agency in the United States.
Yeah.
So in a later interview, Howe pointed out that in an event that happened in the mid-90s was still so sensitive to someone or some organization in 2016 that it was worth this kind of a phone call.
Yeah, right, right.
So the second so-called whistleblower, Spartan 1, came forward a few years later to Howe, and he claimed to be a former Navy SEAL, and his story is maybe even more spectacular. So he said that in 2003, he was on a classified mission as part of a U.S. Navy SEAL special operation team that traveled to Antarctica to investigate, get this, an octagon-shaped structure discovered by ground-penetrating radar that descended deep into the glacier.
So that's awesome. So Antarctica has the Arctic does not have landmass under it, right?
Yes, it does. It's just way under the ground. Yeah.
One of them doesn't.
It's the North Pole, I believe. The North
That's
Pole.
What I'm saying, the Arctic. The Arctic does not, but Antarctica does.
Antarctica does, yes.
Right, so there is like ground to go into there.
Yes.
And like they're like talking about like big holes, which like kind of reminds me of like the some of the Mars anomalies, right? They have these like giant, massive, you know, perfectly circular holes in the surface that look like they lead down into these caverns. And of course, they're like, oh, it's just like geology or whatever. But
just you wait.
Right. Okay.
I'll keep going. Okay. So remember the Beardmore Glacier that Brian's crew flew over?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's where this structure was located. And it was about 93 miles from the McMurdo station. But apparently their team wasn't the first one there. So he claimed that a previous team of scientists and engineers had already been at the site and had dug out the top layer of one octagonal structure made of a black material of some kind that looked kind of like a shiny marble. And it was built on two more octagon-shaped structures buried beneath the ice, which went about 2 miles thick at this location. Whoa. Into the ice. So when Spartan 1 arrived in Antarctica, he was taken by helicopter to McMurdo and then onto the site with ground transportation that drove him there. And when he arrived, he encountered something that blew his mind. So he was led into a doorway that was located about 50 feet beneath the ice. So had to descend 50 feet before coming to this door. And he estimated the walls of the structure is about 18 to 30 feet thick, a ceiling high as around 22 to 28 feet. And he said that the walls, the ceiling, and the floor were all made of this black, shiny-looking marble-type substance. And when you got inside, you know, you'd think it would be freezing. But Spartan 1 said it was a comfortable maybe 68 to 72 degrees. Was also lit up inside, but not by any source that he could identify. So he didn't see any light bulbs. He didn't see any kind of lighting fixtures or anything that would be illuminating the space. But instead, the entire interior was sort of mysteriously lit with this lime green light that seemed to emanate from nowhere and everywhere all at once. And at the time, ground penetrating radar scans had shown not only the shape of the structure, which was octagonal, but also that it spanned about 62 acres. What? And that's like, yeah, so it's huge. It's like half a square kilometer, and it descended far down into the ice. So as he ventured downward and looked around, he noticed that the walls and the doors were covered with these strange hieroglyphic-like symbols.
Oh, and so cool.
I know. And he said that they were about 8 inches high and 2 inches thick. So they were carved in a sort of relief, you know, it's like they had dimension to them. And he didn't recognize them as looking like Egyptian or Mayan hieroglyphics or any that he'd seen, but they shared similarities in that they depicted symbols and animals or creatures on them. And one of the symbols, though, did look familiar to him. And that was a black sun, which is a symbol used by the Nazi SS. And there's a whole other rabbit hole, which I'm not going to go down, but down about Nazis in Antarctica, which aliens, all that, flying saucers, the whole nine. Didn't do that this time. Anyway, by now you may be wondering what Spartan 1's official mission was. So as he explained it, part of it was to transport these scientists who were documenting the structure and the hieroglyphics, and they were taking or trying to take a full inventory of all of it. So he was told that the structure had been built by a humanoid group of extraterrestrials who were involved in the genetic engineering of humanity. And he said there's a coalition of countries involved in this, you know, that collaborate with these aliens. Quote, this coalition that I talk about, it's Great Britain, United States, France, Germany, Canada, Russia. There has been a space fleet in existence for the last 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So then he went on to describe the different extraterrestrial races that collaborate with the space coalition. And he said he has been told of at least 7 different species of aliens that they work with, and they're anywhere from warlike to very peaceful in nature. So they kind of run the gamut.
How many?
7 different species of aliens. Yeah. Okay. So then the third person she interviewed, Spartan 2, claimed to have served in the U.S. Marine Corps and then as an intelligence specialist from 1992 to 2016, so quite a long time. And both he and Spartan 1 talked about there being portals or wormholes, stargates, whatever you want to call them, but doorways into alternate dimensions in Antarctica that can transport you from one part of the Earth or the universe or who knows where to another. Spartan 2 not only corroborated Spartan 1's account of these hieroglyphs, but he did one better, and he said the same symbols, Seth, appear in areas on the moon and on Mars.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I knew it.
So, you know, as I mentioned before, these three guys aren't the only military whistleblowers who've come forward to talk about this mysterious underground base there. Pete Peterson, who's the alleged grandson of Nikola Tesla's engineering assistant, was supposedly hired by the government to work on a number of advanced space technology projects, and he backs up these claims with his own accounts. He says that he was sent to Antarctica on a classified mission to try and interpret alien technology on 3 buried motherships. So, also, there is a ufologist and internet archaeologist named Scott Waring, who claims to have found evidence of underground bases using Google Earth, and he totes thinks it's aliens. He wrote on his website, quote, very interesting and intriguing images from Google Earth, which seem to show 2 possible entrances to an alien base, or at least an entrance to something, and a huge saucer-shaped object buried in the ice. If there are alien bases in the Antarctic, it would follow that there are ET craft there also. And we'll, of course, post pictures. And then finally, some people point to Plato's account of Atlantis, and that's another wormhole you can go down and, you know, not come up for a very long time. But some people think it's buried beneath the ice there. And that would have been destroyed around 11 to 12,000 years ago. But all of this is just the tip of the iceberg. Sorry, had to do it.
But
there are other stories I didn't go in, you know, into at all. But there's a lot out there, including one about an Admiral Byrd who precedes all of these guys and claimed UFOs came out of the water, attacked ships, and shot down planes. Okay. But before you go thinking that all of this is too crazy, you know, there's actually some evidence that Antarctica could be habitable underground. So recent scans have apparently shown enormous caverns beneath the ice that go down into the earth. Most of them are formed by volcanoes, and some of them are so large that they could fit the land the size of Manhattan in them. So that's, you know, an enormous cavern. And because of thermal heating from the inside of the volcano, the temperatures might be downright balmy inside some of these caverns, possibly around like the 72 degree range, which backs up Spartan 1's account. Some people think this points to the hollow earth theory. I kind of feel like, why complicate things further?
Yeah.
Maybe the earth is somewhere in between. You know, there could be creatures and populated places underground, like the ones we've covered in past episodes, like the Mel's Hole episode we did.
Yep.
A bottomless pit stories in one of our previous episodes, but also underground cities. You never know, right? So another bizarre fact about Antarctica is that scientists have detected via satellite imagery a few years back what appeared to be a gigantic hole in the side of a glacier, possibly validating these accounts. It also has one of only 8 known lava lakes in the world. This one is filled with molten lava. Yeah.
What?
So in the middle of the most freezing continent on the planet, you've got this lake of molten fire, right? And it reaches temperatures of over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It also has ice that literally sings, which I thought was super cool. But basically, the ice makes this constant subsonic hum that our ears can't detect,
oh, cool.
but it's there. It's kind of like somebody described it as like a flute playing, but it's caused by the movement of wind against the ice. So an article on livescience.com says, Antarctica's relative peace and quiet make it a useful place for physicists to hunt for quick-moving cosmic rays and elusive elementary particles. Recently, the region's ice hasn't only been absorbing these particles from space, but seemingly spitting them out, too. So this is another mystery and anomaly that's there. Researchers aren't sure what to make of measurements from NASA's Antarctic Impulsive Transient Antenna and the Ice Cube Observatory, both of which are designed to detect space-based phenomena. So far, the identity of the particles detected over Antarctica remain a mystery. And it also has some like sweet green icebergs, which has mystified scientists for a long time, but they recently, you know, came to think it may be from iron oxide dust.
Hmm.
But you know, when you think about Spartan 1's account of the green lighting in the that underground building.
Right.
You know. Kind of makes sense. And also, its ice sheets are believed to contain the oldest ice on Earth.
Wow.
So who knows what could be buried beneath them.
Wow. Very cool. I mean, like, I definitely heard about, you know, people talking about bases in Antarctica and, like, especially, like, Nazi bases. That's, like, a big thing, right? Right. But just, I never really thought about it that much, to be honest. And, like, yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the most, or probably the most, like, unexplored, uninhabited, for sure, continents in the world. Like,
right.
there's nothing down there. There's, like, penguins on the surface, at least, right? Like, that's it. There's nothing else there. And, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much ice all the time. I mean, there's a ground under it. I don't know if that's, like, all volcanic or whatever, but certainly if you were, like, trying to hide your UFO would be a great place to.
That would be the place to do it. You know, yeah. If you kind of want to be undisturbed with your alien collabs,
yeah,
where you're making, you know, half human hybrids, that would
totally.
Be the place.
I love this like story about them finding this like octagonal structure like under the ground that's like still they can get into, and it's, I don't know, like, you know, got light inside of it and all that. Like, I never really, you know, heard about that, where there's these like actual places to go into that people have seen. It's always these stories about like, you know, oh, people have seen, you know, UFOs coming and going or whatever, but, or even these holes. I mean, I feel like people look on Google Earth and stuff, right, for these holes or,
oh, yeah.
or spaceships under the water or under the ice. That's like a whole thing, right? Yeah. Well, anyways, very cool. Yeah, we should definitely go more into Antarctica. You've definitely piqued my curiosity there. But okay, cool. Are you ready? Are you ready for mine?
Yeah, bring it.
Okay, so I got like a little like intro here. I just want to talk about a little bit more about just like UFOs and the military and just sort of like the whole history here, right? I mean, there's definitely, you know, certainly contention about when UFOs started, you know, appearing on our horizons. Many believe that there's evidence suggests they've been here with us for a very long time. Some even think before mankind. But whatever your belief is about how long they've been here and if they exist at all, in terms of documented reports of unidentified flying objects, they definitely grew substantially in number after the beginning of the atomic age. So along with their interest in nuclear weapons, UFOs have been known to encounter Air Force pilots. Like I said before, one of the first UFO sightings was by an Air Force pilot. And this started all the way back to World War II. So glowing orbs and other unidentified lights used to buzz and pursue squadrons when they were out on missions. So much so that they even got their own slang name, which was Foo Fighters. So that's where the band Foo Fighters comes in. It's like, so this is obviously, or maybe not so obviously, a reference to the belief that they were Japanese in origin, right? Foo obviously sounds a lot more Chinese to me, but I'm not a World War II pilot. So even though, you know, even though they believe that, I think that the Japanese actually saw them too, right? And they certainly never took credit for any such technology. But these orbs had the ability to travel at much faster speeds and outmaneuver what was certainly the most advanced aerial technology of that age, right? So they were like flying circles, literally and figuratively, around these squadrons. And sometimes these orbs would actually travel in threes and they would sort of like spin about each other. And sometimes they would actually mess with the planes, even getting so close to them as to, like, you know, almost cause crashes. And sometimes they would just simply follow them and observe. But just recently, like we talked about, you know, the Air Force has released videos of these types of encounters, right? Like, I don't know if they were the same type of Foo Fighter encounters, but they've definitely released, you know, footage of them tracking UFOs. So, yeah, back to the whole nuclear thing. I mean, certainly correlation does not necessitate causation, but there are definite statistics that point out that UFO sightings and encounters are more prevalent around nuclear reactors and especially nuclear weapon facilities, right? There's just simply statistically more sightings there. And this is, you know, recently been underscored by some of these, the release of some of these Air Force reports, you know, a subject that they, you know, used to dismiss and now they've admitted to taking very seriously. So many of these reports by servicemen often centered around UFOs interested in, like I said, nuclear facilities and specifically warheads. And not only do they observe them, but they're regularly known to shut them down. Right? Okay. So here's some cool stories. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So the first is kind of a famous one, I think, for the UK. It's sort of like their Roswell. And this is the Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest incident. Okay. So this is a report of a series of incidents that occurred in the late 1980 at Bentwaters Royal Air Force Base in England. Bentwaters was used as by the U.S. Air Force as a strategic European location during the Cold War, and it housed a secret cache of nuclear weapons held in 25 underground bunkers. So one night, U.S. Air Force air traffic controller Ivan Barker noticed an anomaly on the radar. In his words, we looked up on the radar scope and saw something not like anything I'd seen before. He and his two colleagues watched it move across the radar and sort of like, you know, they were sort of shocked by its speed and maneuverability. On the radar, they said it covered 120 miles in a matter of seconds. In the words of Barker, who was at that point an 18-year veteran, right? This is a guy who's been like watching things on radars for like the better part of 20 years. And he said he knew about, quote, about every aircraft in the U.S., NATO, and Soviet bloc. And it had to be moving Mach 5, 6, 7, or 8 faster than anything other than possibly a missile. So now Barker looks up. They're in their control room. They're sort of like looking up at the sky now. And they actually see this thing move into view. And he says it's about 1,500 to 1,200 feet high and at least a city block in diameter. And it just sits there completely stationary, no movement at all, say like a helicopter would, right? So it's not like hovering in the sense of like dipping slowly up and down, you know, in the air. It's just solidly there, city block in diameter, right?
Crazy.
He describes it as a giant basketball with portals emanating light around the center. And he said there was nothing aerodynamic about it. Basketballs don't fly. Of course, unless you throw them, I guess. So basically it moves over the water tower and it stops only for a few seconds before completely reversing its course and disappearing in the direction it had come. He said, swish, it's gone. I don't know why he has all these sports metaphors, but Barker did not report the sighting to his superiors at the time for fear of consequences, right? A lot of these people were they had this like constant evaluation for mental health that they would, you know, that was sort of held over their heads, when stuff like this would come up. However, you know, a lot of these people were actually like vetted very seriously, right? Like people who are working at a nuclear, warhead facility, like they're vetted the same way, probably even more so than, astronauts or something, right? Where they're given psychological evaluations, they're constantly monitored for their mental health. So there was, however, other witnesses to these events, as there were further encounters in the nearby Rendlesham Forest and a reported landing. Strange lights of blue, red, and orange and white have been seen in the area. So one of the individuals who was
like
asked,
all at once or separately?
What do you mean? Like
all those colors?
I think it was like in succession. Like they had just been seeing lights and they were of all these different colors. So one of the individuals who was asked to investigate this phenomenon coming out of the forest was U.S. Air Force Officer John Burroughs. Okay, so these are his words. The woods lit up and you could hear the farm animals making a lot of noises. You could see the lights down by the farmer's house on the edge of the forest. We climbed over the fence and started walking towards the red and blue lights, and just then they disappeared. So USAF Officer Jim Peniston was also with him and reported seeing a craft that landed nearby and that it was, covered in hieroglyphic-like symbols, right? Much like the ones that you were just talking about. Which in a little sidebar, I've heard in the internet, urban legends and stuff, that some of these hieroglyphics are meant to imbue certain parts of a UFO with properties, right? Like they'll actually put these hieroglyphics on as a way of essentially programming different parts of a craft, right? Like that's some of the weird, cool thoughts.
Programming different parts? What do you mean?
That the
hieroglyphics, so it's almost like code or something?
Yeah, that they're like the hieroglyphics are actually like a programming language that they use to program objects, essentially. So by inscribing them with these, which sounds a lot like sort of like magic, right? But that's the sort of like lore that's out there about these things. Okay, so this is in his words. I estimated it to be about 3 meters tall and about 3 meters wide at the base. No landing gear was apparent, but it seemed like it was on. She was on fixed legs. I moved a little closer. I walked around the craft, and finally, I walked right up to the craft. I noticed the fabric of the shell was more like a smooth, opaque, black glass. Right? That's a pretty cool description of, yeah, of the material itself. The next
and it's
morning,
kind of like the similar to, you know, how Spartan 1 described the material for the building.
Yeah, that's
black,
right.
Black marble-like material.
That's crazy,
shiny,
right?
With the hieroglyphs, yeah.
Yeah, that is really interesting. A little bit of synchronicity there, right?
No.
Okay, so that was that encounter. But the next morning, upon investigation, indentations were found on that spot, along with damage to the surrounding trees, and unusually high levels of radiation were also recorded. So there was evidence of something happening there, right? It wasn't just like, oh, they saw these lights, but there was some physical remnant of this encounter. So then, two nights later, on December 27th, USAF Colonel Charles Halt sat waiting for any further incidents to occur, right? So clearly they were waiting for more to happen, but he was there ready to disprove any crazy theories about what exactly was happening. He was apparently a pragmatist, and, like, you know, the people at the base had been talking. So he was ready, and he got his chance. So more lights were spotted, and so he grabbed his tape recorder and joined a patrol group. So the subsequent recording he made, however, disproved nothing, and in fact is now considered to be one of the most valuable pieces of evidence from this now famous incident. In Colonel Halt's words from the recording, "It looks like an eye winking at you. Here it comes from the south. He's coming towards us now. We're observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. This is unreal." And I think what is the most interesting about this recording is, like, the excitement in their voices, right? These are people who have been in the military for decades, right? They've been seeing aircraft for decades. They know every single aircraft, at least as far as the Air Force is concerned, what they all look like, how they all operate, you know, even like experimental or secret craft from other countries, they're probably going to know about, right? So literally, these are the experts, right? Like, if you saw a light in the sky and you weren't sure about what it was, and you were like, let's get an expert to look at this, these are the people you would call, right? There's, like, no one more qualified to comment on what they're seeing moving around the sky than, an Air Force colonel that's entrusted with a nuclear warhead facility, right? Yeah. Right. So, yeah. Like, I would imagine you'd want to, like, sort of trust the word on this. And I think, like I said, like, the most interesting thing is the excitement in their voices, right? And he says multiple times throughout this recording, there is no doubt this is weird. Okay, so this audio tape has since been declassified, and it's now public domain. So I'm going to try playing some of it for you.
Ooh, cool. Okay.
So, okay, I'm going to play it now. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Oh, we're falling off it again.
But it just moved to the right.
Yeah.
Off the right.
Strange. Oh, well, why don't you left? Let's approach to the edge of the woods up there. Can you undo that light? Let's do it carefully. Come on. Okay, we're looking at the thing. We're probably about 200 to 300 yards away. It looks like an eye winking at you. It's still moving from side to side. And when you put the star scope on it, it sort of has a hollow center, a dark center. It's like the pupil of an eye looking at you and winking. And the flash is so bright to the star scope that it almost burns your eye. We passed the farmer's house and across into the next field. Now we have multiple sightings of up to 5 lights with a similar shape and all, but they seem to be steady now rather than a pulsating or glow with a red flash. We just crossed the creek.
Here we go.
And we're getting what kind of readings now? Getting through 3 good clicks on the meter, and we're seeing strange lights in the sky. 244, we're at the far side of the farmer's.
Okay, well, you get the picture.
Wow, yeah, totally. Yeah, you can hear the
they're excited,
there's, like,
right?
Breathless excitement.
There's,
yeah,
like, a breathless excitement. And this is, like, you know, this is a colonel in the Air Force who would, like, for sure lose his job for fucking around, right? Like, these are people that, like, aren't in a hurry to, you know, to put their reputation on their line, to be not taken seriously.
Right.
So the fact that he made this recording and that it was, I think, eventually played for a general and like it made its rounds. It's like I said, it's public domain now. You know, these aren't people who are like trying to fuck around with this stuff. So, okay. So, you know, some of the witnesses at that event actually ended up getting post-traumatic stress disorder.
Really?
Yeah.
Were they, yeah. So they were afraid?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just the whole thing is like kind of shattering, right? Like they, you know, especially because, you know, as per usual, the sort of fallout of this whole thing was like, don't talk about this. You didn't see any of this stuff. And then they like play the record and they're like, yeah, no. I think one of the guys said he was like, he was in awe of technology for like decades after that. Like it almost like put this like fear and awe of him about like what the real possibilities were.
Interesting.
And I think one of them said that one of the ones who suffer from post traumatic stress disorder, again, these are people that are regularly evaluated for, you know, any type of mental condition or instability or whatever. One of them believes he had a binary data downloaded into his brain. So.
Whoa.
So that was all from the...
Like during this experience?
During this experience, yeah.
Oh.
This is all from the Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest incident. And of course there's like theories that like came up after that, like, you know, there's a lot of like naysayers like, oh, it was like they saw cars. It was like one of the like that was one of the explanation was that there was cars driving by.
Like,
I mean,
headlights.
Come on, dude.
Isn't it the old like, oh, it's headlight reflection?
Yeah.
In the distance.
Like, oh my god. Anyways. Hmm. But okay. So that was what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna do one more here.
Okay.
Okay, so this last one obviously occurred in England. This one is in the United States, and this is the Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana encounters. Okay. So Malmstrom is an Air Force base located in Cascade County, Montana, adjacent to the city of Great Falls. It was built around 1942, and it became the 341st Strategic Missile Wing in 1959. By 1967, Malmstrom's missile field was the largest in the U.S., with four missile squadrons equipped with a total of 200 Minuteman II missiles. Okay, wow. So like, let that sink in for a second. Like, we throw around these numbers, but they're very big numbers. Okay, so the Minuteman LGM-30 is a land-based intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, meaning that they can strike and counterattack targets in, like, Soviet cities, right? That's basically what these things were designed to do. And this is, you know, a site like this is essentially what we think about when we think about, like, an endgame nuclear war. These things, this
like
place.
Someone with their hand on the button.
Yeah. This place is ready to start and end.
These.
Yeah, a nuclear war, right? And to my knowledge, still is, right? There's still ICBMs there. You know, I think there was, at one point, at least in the United States, thousands of warheads, right? And just because we throw around these numbers, like 200, 1,000, one of these can wipe out a city. One.
Right.
So when
so
we're
it's
talking about.
Like, how many 200. Times over could we destroy the earth?
Right, right. We're not talking about, like, you know, just wiping out, like, part of Europe. We're talking about the end of fucking humanity here, right? That's how much firepower that it's kind of a sickening amount, right? Like,
right.
This should not be in the hands of fucking anybody.
Right.
Right? Okay, so this place is heavy duty. And in fact, it's one of the launch facilities that went on strategic alert during the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? So this place is fucking ready to go. It's been on strategic alert before, right? Like, this place was ready to push a button and blow some shit up. So not only does Malmstrom contain weapons capable of wiping out entire cities, but it is also home to a number of UFO encounters during the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, some of which included several ICBMs inexplicably going offline and on more than one occasion. Okay, so in 1967, former USAF Minutemen ICBM targeting officer Robert C. Jameson states that he assisted in the restart of an entire flight of 10 Minutemen ICBMs, which had all mysteriously and simultaneously gone offline immediately following a UFO sighting in the area. Okay, so again, I just want to like dwell on that number for a second. Like, it sounds like, oh, it's like a flight of Minutemen. And like, Minutemen's almost like a cute name. It's also like a punk rock band, right, from like the 80s or something. 10 Minutemen missiles, you know, aimed at a target would be absolutely catastrophic, right? Like, this is something like really fucking horrific. And so for 10 of them to go offline simultaneously is actually like a massively big deal. Okay, so, if, you know, the U.S. military thought for even a moment that the UAF was Soviet, right, like that this UFO or this anomaly that took place came from, you know, Soviet Russia or from any foreign power for that matter, this would start an all-out war, right? Like, think of the Bay of Pigs, think about just the discovery of a weapon-ready, like, location in a nearby country almost led to nuclear war in a matter of days, right? So, and this is also, like, extremely secure airspace, right? Like, nothing's coming and going to this airspace that they're not tracking by normal standards, right? So they know what's going on there. And, you know, so if something's coming into the airspace that they think is terrestrial, that's coming from a hostile country, like, this is a big deal, right? So the fact that this did not escalate is, I think, an indication of what they thought this thing might be. Okay. So, you know, but the point is, whatever you believe in UFOs, God, great nature, or whatever, or just synchronicity, clearly the universe was sending a message here, right? And the message was, shut them down, right? Something took those warheads offline that day and then came back to do it again. Okay, so back to the story. All right, Jameson said that while they were there to repair the offline flight, they were ordered as a precaution to remain at Malmstrom until all UFO reports from the field had ceased, right? So there was clearly multiple reports here, and they were prepared for further incidents. So while he was at the missile maintenance hangar, waiting to potentially go back out into the field, he overheard people from the command post having a conversation over the two-way radio about another sighting in the nearby town of Belt. And this turned out to be another well-documented sighting in Montana on March 24th and 25th in 1967 of that year. Okay, so Jameson said that about 2 weeks after the original incident, he and his team responded to another shutdown. This time it was partial, involving 4 or 5 ICBMs, right? Again, this is enough to wipe out like half of Europe. Before he was sent out to repair this, his team received a report that another UFO had been sighted directly above the flight's launch control facility. Right. So this is like the whole, like, you know, when the UFOs were sighted above the White House, whenever that was, this is crazy, right? That anything would be in the airspace above a launch control facility is a huge deal. So he said this, not only that, this incident took place during the day in broad daylight. He later spoke to several of the security guards who had witnessed the UFO, and they said they were visibly shaken by the experience. And so there, you know, over the years, there's been count after count of report after report of sightings of nuclear warheads going offline, of just like, you know, general UFO activity that's documented. Some of them were so meticulously documented, it was like almost boring to go through. I tried to like read, there was like several of them I read through, and it's just like tracking it. They would see these things on a regular basis over decades, right? So, these are like very particular encounters and incidences, but, you know, we couldn't possibly cover all the ones that have happened out there. There are many, right? And I've even heard reports in documentaries and stuff where they've actually knocked them out of the sky, right? Where they were doing warhead testing. And I think one pilot said he actually saw a UFO come up and like beam into one of these things, and it just like fell. So wow. They're definitely interested in these
things. So it actually shot down a missile.
Essentially, yeah, like disabled it. These things do not like us, whatever they are. Like I said before, like whether this is like UFOs, God, great natures, whatever it is, something is telling us we're not supposed to be using these things.
Right.
And it just makes sense, right? Like, you know, a lot of people who have had abduction encounters said they felt treated like an animal during these encounters, where they felt like, you know, kind of how we are about dolphins and chimpanzees, you know, in the science community, will walk up and, you know, tranquilize an animal because we think it's so lesser than us, right? Mm-hmm. Like that we're so far superior to them, and they're so sort of unintelligent that we have the right to handle them in this way. So you can imagine, you know, an intelligent species seeing a chimpanzee playing with nuclear weapons.
Right.
Like if a human being saw a chimpanzee handling a nuclear weapon, their impulse would be to turn it off. Right.
So roughly how many of these stories did you come across? I know you didn't do all of them, but just
In this last, I don't know, yeah. A dozen or something. Okay. I mean, over the years, like I mm-hmm. don't know, countless. Like mm-hmm. I said, there's statistical, I think KUFON, the computer UFO network or whatever, it's sort of like MUFON, like they have like a massive database of sightings and encounters over the years, and they've compiled statistics about sightings and encounters around nuclear facilities, and there is a strong statistical indication that these things are very interesting. So there's like, there has to be hundreds, if not thousands, of reports around nuclear facilities, including, you know, not just, I've sort of focused on, nuclear warheads and stuff, but they're also known to, you know, scan, what's this called? Like nuclear power plants, right? Those tend, I think even, was it Point Pleasant, one of the biggest like sort of hotbeds of UFO activity, had, you know, a nuclear facility nearby. I think, a lot of the sightings and the sort of like, you know, a UFO activity around bases and stuff out west, you know, a lot of these places are connected to nuclear test sites, right? And like I said, the beginning of the podcast, there was a major increase of UFO sightings after the beginning of the atomic age, right? It's hard to like, again, you know, correlate, you know, like that right. There's actually a cause there, but it is a correlation.
Right. Is it some subconscious fear that people are kind of projecting out into the skies, and or is it something more tangible?
I mean, I think about it this way, right? Like if we accept that there's the possibility of an intelligent life there that's been out somewhere out there that's been evolving for 20 million years, let's say, right? There's life on Earth that's been evolving that long, right? So why not out there, right? Human life hasn't been evolving that long, but, you know, we talked about with the dolphins, they've developed some parts of their, you know, emotional brain that have, you know, superseded humanity. So imagine like that there's somewhere, some beings out there that can travel light years, right? And so that they would take notice. People like, and like I said, chimpanzees, right? Like that's got to be how they see us, right? Like setting off nuclear warheads, you would go investigate, right? Like, you would go check it out, see what they're up to. Why are they doing that? Right. And see if you could, like, maybe stop it.
Especially if you had a vested interest in, you know, you had a base in Antarctica under the ice and you weren't done with all of your experiments yet, your genetic mutations and
totally
so forth.
Right. Right. Like, you've got, well, I mean, but like, but seriously though, like, if there was like, I imagine that, you know, setting off nuclear explosions must have an effect, right? Like, it must have some sort of wave, right? Like, it's catastrophic when it happens here on the surface of the planet. But, you know, certainly if something like worse happened, it would have a repercussion throughout the solar system, which would then have a repercussion throughout the galaxy. And so, you know, I don't know. I think there's like definitely reason to believe that that would call the attention of any intelligent life that's out there.
Right. That was interesting. So what do you think, Seth?
Oh, yeah, I definitely
you believe it, yeah.
I feel like definitely, like, there's definitely, like, times on this podcast where I'm like, I don't know, like, maybe, you know, but this, I definitely feel like, you know, this is kind of like I wrote my book about, which is, like, this idea that, you know, we've called, like, we're not alone in this world, in this universe, and, you know, I think that we've long since called the attention of something else out there. And I think that us setting off, you know, us trying to kill each other with these, you know, solar level energy type of, like, you know, destructive devices, that something out there is like, okay, you guys aren't allowed to leave the planet. You guys aren't allowed to, you know, you guys aren't allowed to set these things off. Like, I think if humanity, like, geared up and really tried to start, you know, using these things, I think something would intervene. Right. And I don't think it has just happened to the United States and, you know, in the UK. I'm sure that stuff like this has happened in Russia, whether they've talked about it or not, right? Or other nuclear powers, right? Like, I'm sure this isn't, isolated to the Western world, right? So yeah. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I was just thinking as you were talking, like, in the writing world, there's this idea of the reliable narrator or not. And I feel
right.
You know, these people that we've both brought to the forefront, especially you, you know, are definitely, you know, they kind of come down on the side of reliability, you know, like, if you're going to trust anyone's account, and, you know, even played us something where you can actually hear the emotion in their voice. And
yeah,
so I think that I definitely think that there are things that have happened that we can't explain and we don't understand. And, you know, when it comes to our capability to destroy the entire planet and then some.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to say that I don't believe that there may not have been some intervention, whether that's alien, whether that's some kind of supernatural thing, whatever that is, I don't know.
Right.
Interdimensional, whatever. I'm sure there are a lot of theories out there about it. But it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely a message in there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if we're willing to, like, listen to it. And, like, I think the message is even more important than the origin of it, right? Like, if something down there is, like, shutting down our weapons, if something's, like, clearly watching us, intervening, like, maybe we should listen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah. I definitely think there's something in there. And, yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, the whole, you know, a reliable witness is a big deal here, right? Like, again, I just feel like, you know, if there's anybody who's qualified to, like, observe an experience like this, and to report on an experience like this.
Right. I mean, as you said, their entire jobs involve just kind of watching the skies and determining what's going where.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, who would you trust more than these people, right? Like, I like, really do feel, I mean, like, yeah, like, I guess, like, a scientist, but someone who's not, you know, like, your average scientist isn't necessarily as versed in, you know, what type of aerial technology that's out there, right? Or, you know, or, I mean, I guess maybe, like, you know, an engineer, but a lot of these military personnel are engineers, right? So, you know, I just don't know who else we met or to like sort of encounter these things and comment on it and be sort of shocked and moved by it, right? Like, I think that's a really interesting, that there's something in that that I think is worth paying attention to. And I just think it's so weird that right now, like, you know, we've basically the military has come out and said, yeah, we don't know what these things are here. There is something here. We don't know what it is. It's not, they don't say it's not terrestrial. They say it, they're like very careful about it. Just like they reframe the whole, like, you know, unidentified aero phenomena thing. They say it's like definitely not of any technology they know of any of the, you know, countries on Earth, right? They're like, this isn't, essentially is not terrestrial technology, right? This isn't technology that was developed on this planet. I think that's what they called it. Like, basically, they're like, this is off-world technology, and off-world technology has to imply some type of extraterrestrial, just in the sense of like, you know, whoever developed it was not on this planet, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, we could do an entire episode about that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, technologies that, you know, beg the
have
question,
their origin
where,
those,
you know, yeah, yeah, were they where, otherworldly, or
yeah,
they
totally
have their origins on Earth.
Cool. Well, I feel like we really got into this one. This is
yeah, we did. We really went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. I'm surprised we haven't done this earlier. I don't know. I just feel like it was definitely apropos. It was definitely timely with all the stuff coming out. But like, this is a subject that's interested me for a long time. So I'm glad we did it.
Me too.
Cool. Right, okay. So I guess we did it. So
yeah.
Until next time.
Until next time. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Tim.